Chapter 8. The Conclusion. In religion, as in every other subject of human reasoning, much depends upon the order in which we dispose our inquiries. A man who takes up a system of divinity with a previous opinion that either every part must be true or the whole false, approaches the discussion with great disadvantage. No other system, which is founded upon moral evidence, would bear to be treated in the same manner. Nevertheless, in a certain degree, we are all introduced to our religious studies under this prejudication, and it cannot be avoided. The weakness of the human judgment in the early part of youth, yet its extreme susceptibility of impression, renders it necessary to furnish it with some opinions and with some principles or other. Or indeed, without much express care or much endeavor for this purpose, the tendency of the mind of man to assimilate itself to the habits of thinking and speaking which prevail around him produces the same effect. That indifferency and suspense, that waiting and equilibrium of the judgment which some require in religious matters, and which some would wish to be aimed at in the conduct of education, are impossible to be preserved. They are not given to the condition of human life. It is a consequence of this institution that the doctrines of religion come to us before the proofs, and come to us with that mixture of explications and inferences from which no public creed is or can be free. And the effect which too frequently follows from Christianity being presented to the understanding in this form is that when any articles which appear as parts of it contradict the apprehension of the persons to whom it is proposed, men of rash and confident tempers hastily and indiscriminately reject the whole. But is this to do justice either to themselves or to the religion? The rational way of treating a subject of such acknowledged importance is to attend, in the first place, to the general and substantial truth of its principles, and to that alone. When we once feel a foundation, when we once perceive a ground of credibility in its history, we shall proceed with safety to inquire into the interpretation of its records and into the doctrines which have been deduced from them. Nor will it either endanger our faith or diminish or alter our motives for obedience if we should discover that these conclusions are formed with very different degrees of probability and possess very different degrees of importance. This conduct of the understanding, dictated by every rule of right reasoning, will uphold personal Christianity, even in those countries in which it is established under forms the most liable to difficulty and objection. It will also have the further effect of guarding us against the prejudices which are wont to arise in our minds to the disadvantage of religion from observing the numerous controversies which are carried on amongst its professors, and likewise of inducing a spirit of lenity and moderation in our judgment as well as in our treatment of those who stand, in such controversies, upon sides opposite to ours. What is clear in Christianity we shall find to be sufficient and to be infinitely valuable. What is dubious, unnecessary to be decided, or of very subordinate importance, and what is most obscure, will teach us to bear with the opinions which others may have formed upon the same subject. We shall say to those who the most widely dissent from us what Augustine said to the worst heretics of his age, Illi in vos seviant, qui nasciunt, cum quo labor verum inveniatur, et quam difficile caviantur errors. Qui nesciunt, cure quanta difficultate sanetur oculus interioris hominis, qui nesciunt, quibus suspiris e gemitibus fiat, ut ex quantulacumque parte possit intelligi Deus. August contra Epfund Captain Lernen 23. A judgment, moreover, which is once pretty well satisfied of the general truth of the religion, will not only thus discriminate in its doctrines, but will possess sufficient strength to overcome the reluctance of the imagination to admit articles of faith which are attended with difficulty of apprehension, if such articles of faith appear to be truly parts of the revelation. It was to be expected beforehand that what related to the economy and to the persons of the invisible world, which revelation professed to do, and which, if true, it actually does, should contain some points remote from our analogies and from the comprehension of a mind which hath acquired all its ideas from sense and from experience. It hath been my care in the preceding work to preserve the separation between evidences and doctrines as inviolable as I could, to remove from the primary question all considerations which have been unnecessarily joined with it, and to offer a defense to Christianity which every Christian might read without seeing the tenets in which he had been brought up, attacked, or decried. And it always afforded a satisfaction to my mind to observe that this was practicable, that few or none of our many controversies with one another affect or relate to the proofs of our religion, that the rent never descends to the foundation. The truth of Christianity depends upon its leading facts, and upon them alone. Now, of these we have evidence which ought to satisfy us, at least until it appear that mankind have ever been deceived by the same. We have some uncontested and incontestable points, to which the history of the human species hath nothing similar to offer. A Jewish peasant changed the religion of the world, and that without force, without power, without support, without one natural source or circumstance of attraction, influence, or success. Such a thing hath not happened in any other instance. The companions of this person, after he himself had been put to death for his attempt, asserted his supernatural character, founded upon his supernatural operations, and, in testimony of the truth of their assertions, i.e., in consequence of their own belief of that truth, and in order to communicate the knowledge of it to others, voluntarily entered upon lives of toil and hardship, and, with a full experience of their danger, committed themselves to the last extremities of persecution. This hath not a parallel. More particularly, a very few days after this person had been publicly executed, and in the very city in which he was buried, these his companions declared with one voice that his body was restored to life, that they had seen him, handled him, ate with him, conversed with him, and in pursuance of their persuasion of the truth of what they told, preached his religion, with this strange fact as the foundation of it, in the face of those who had killed him, who were armed with the power of the country, and necessarily and naturally disposed to treat his followers as they had treated himself. And having done this upon the spot where the event took place, carried the intelligence of it abroad, in despite of difficulties and opposition, and where the nature of their errand gave them nothing to expect but derision, insult, and outrage. This is without example. These three facts, I think, are certain, and would have been nearly so if the Gospels had never been written. The Christian story as to these points hath never varied. No other hath been set up against it. Every letter, every discourse, every controversy amongst the followers of the religion, every book written by them from the age of its commencement to the present time, in every part of the world in which it hath been professed, and with every sect into which it hath been divided, and we have letters and discourses written by contemporaries, by witnesses of the transaction, by persons themselves bearing a share in it, and other writings following that again regular succession, concur in representing these facts in this manner. A religion which now possesses the greatest part of the civilized world unquestionably sprang up at Jerusalem at this time. Some account must be given of its origin, some cause assigned for its rise. All the accounts of this origin, all the explications of this cause, whether taken from the writings of the early followers of the religion, in which, and in which perhaps alone, it could be expected that they should be distinctly unfolded, or from occasional notices in other writings of that or the adjoining age, either expressly allege the facts above, stated as the means by which the religion was set up, or advert to its commencement in a manner which agrees with the supposition of these facts being true, and which testifies their operation and effects. These prepositions alone lay a foundation for our faith, for they prove the existence of a transaction which cannot even, in its most general parts, be accounted for upon any reasonable supposition, except that of the truth of the mission. But the particulars, the detail of the miracles or miraculous pretenses, for such there necessarily must have been, upon which this unexampled transaction rested, and for which these men acted and suffered as they did act and suffer, it is undoubtedly of great importance to us to know. We have this detail from the fountainhead, from the persons themselves, in accounts written by eyewitnesses of the scene, by contemporaries and companions of those who were so, not in one book, but four, each containing enough for the verification of the religion, all agreeing in the fundamental parts of the history. We have the authenticity of these books established by more and stronger proofs than belong to almost any other ancient book whatever. and by proofs which widely distinguish them from any others claiming a similar authority to theirs. If there were any good reason for doubt concerning the names to which these books are ascribed, which there is not, for they were never ascribed to any other, and we have evidence not long after their publication of their bearing the names which they now bear, their antiquity, of which there is no question, their reputation and authority amongst the early disciples of the religion, of which there is as little, form a valid proof that they must, in the main at least, have agreed with what the first teachers of the religion delivered. When we open these ancient volumes, we discover in them marks of truth, whether we consider each in itself or collate them with one another. The writers certainly knew something of what they were writing about, for they manifest an acquaintance with local circumstances, with the history and usages of the times, which could belong only to an inhabitant of that country living in that age. In every narrative we perceive simplicity and undesignedness, the air and the language of reality. When we compare the different narratives together, we find them so varying as to repel all suspicion of confederacy, so agreeing under this variety as to show that the accounts had one real transaction for their common foundation, often attributing different actions and discourses to the person whose history, or rather memoirs of whose history, they profess to relate, yet actions and discourses so similar as very much to bespeak the same character, which is a coincidence that, in such writers as they were, could only be the consequence of their writing from fact and not from imagination. These four narratives are confined to the history of the founder of the religion and end with his ministry. Since, however, it is certain that the affair went on, we cannot help being anxious to know how it proceeded. This intelligence hath come down to us in a work purporting to be written by a person himself connected with the business during the first stages of its progress, taking up the story where the former histories had left it, carrying on the narrative, oftentimes with great particularity, and throughout with the appearance of good sense, information, and candor, stating all along the origin, and the only probable origin, of effects which unquestionably were produced, together with the natural consequences of situations which unquestionably did exist, and confirmed in the substance at least of the account by the strongest possible accession of testimony which a history can receive, original letters written by the person who is the principal subject of the history, written upon the business to which the history relates, and during the period, or soon after the period, which the history comprises. No man can say that this altogether is not a body of strong historical evidence. See Peter's speech upon curing the cripple, Acts 3:1, the Council of the Apostles, 15, Paul's discourse at Athens, 17:22, before Agrippa, 26. I notice these passages, both as fraught with good sense and as free from the smallest tincture of enthusiasm. When we reflect that some of those from whom the books proceeded are related to have themselves wrought miracles, to have been the subject of miracles, or of supernatural assistance in propagating the religion, we may perhaps be led to think that more credit, or a different kind of credit, is due to these accounts than what can be claimed by merely human testimony. But this is an argument which cannot be addressed to skeptics or unbelievers. A man must be a Christian before he can receive it. The inspiration of the historical scriptures, the nature, degree, and extent of that inspiration, are questions undoubtedly of serious discussion, but they are questions amongst Christians themselves and not between them and others. The doctrine itself is by no means necessary to the belief of Christianity, which must, in the first instance at least, depend upon the ordinary maxim of historical credibility. See Powell's Discourse, Disc 15, p. 25. In viewing the detail of miracles recorded in these books, we find every supposition negatived by which they can be resolved into fraud or delusion. They were not secret, nor momentary, nor tentative, nor ambiguous, nor performed under the sanction of authority, with the spectators on their side, or in affirmance of tenets and practices already established. We find also the evidence alleged for them, and which evidence was by great numbers received, different from that upon which other miraculous accounts rest. It was contemporary, it was published upon the spot, it continued, It involved interests and questions of the greatest magnitude. It contradicted the most fixed persuasions and prejudices of the persons to whom it was addressed. It required from those who accepted it not a simple indolent assent, but a change from thenceforward of principles and conduct, a submission to consequences the most serious and the most deterring, to loss and danger, to insult, outrage, and persecution. How such a story should be false, or, if false, how under such circumstances it should make its way, I think impossible to be explained. Yet such the Christian story was, such were the circumstances under which it came forth, and in opposition to such difficulties did it prevail. An event so connected with the religion and with the fortunes of the Jewish people, as one of their race, one born amongst them, establishing his authority and his law throughout a great portion of the civilized world, it was perhaps to be expected should be noticed in the prophetic writings of that nation, especially when this person, together with his own mission, caused also to be acknowledged the divine original of their institution and by those who before had altogether rejected it. Accordingly, we perceive in these writings various intimations concurring in the person and history of Jesus, in a manner and in a degree in which passages taken from these books could not be made to concur in any person arbitrarily assumed, or in any person except him who has been the author of great changes in the affairs and opinions of mankind. Of some of these predictions, the weight depends a good deal upon the concurrence. Others possess great separate strength. One in particular does this in an eminent degree. It is an entire description, manifestly directed to one character and to one scene of things. It is extant in a writing or collection of writings, declaredly prophetic, and it applies to Christ's character and to the circumstances of his life and death with considerable precision, and in a way which no diversity of interpretation hath, in my opinion, been able to confound. That the advent of Christ and the consequences of it should not have been more distinctly revealed in the Jewish sacred books is, I think, in some measure accounted for by the consideration that for the Jews to have foreseen the fall of their institution, and that it was to merge at length into a more perfect and comprehensive dispensation, would have cooled too much, and relaxed their zeal for it, and their adherence to it, upon which zeal and adherence the preservation in the world of any remains for many ages of religious truth might in a great measure depend. Of what a revelation discloses to mankind, one and only one, question can properly be asked. Was it of importance to mankind to know or to be better assured of? In this question, when we turn our thoughts to the great Christian doctrine of the resurrection of the dead and of a future judgment, no doubt can possibly be entertained. He who gives me riches or honors does nothing. He who even gives me health does little, in comparison with that which lays before me just grounds for expecting a restoration to life and a day of account and retribution, which thing Christianity hath done for millions. Other articles of the Christian faith, although of infinite importance when placed beside any other topic of human inquiry, are only the adjuncts and circumstances of this. They are, however, such as appear worthy of the original to which we ascribe them. The morality of the religion, whether taken from the precepts or the example of its founder, or from the lessons of its primitive teachers, derived, as it should seem, from what had been inculcated by their master, is, in all its parts, wise and pure, neither adapted to vulgar prejudices, nor flattering popular notions, nor excusing established practices, but calculated, in the matter of its instruction, truly to promote human happiness, and in the form in which it was conveyed, to produce impression and effect, a morality which, let it have proceeded from any person whatever, would have been satisfactory evidence of his good sense and integrity, of the soundness of his understanding and the probity of his designs, a morality, in every view of it, much more perfect than could have been expected from the natural circumstances and character of the person who delivered it, a morality, in a word, which is, and hath been, most beneficial to mankind. Upon the greatest, therefore, of all possible occasions, and for a purpose of inestimable value, it pleased the deity to vouchsafe a miraculous attestation. Having done this for the institution, when this alone could fix its authority or give to it a beginning, he committed its future progress to the natural means of human communication and to the influence of those causes by which human conduct and human affairs are governed. The seed being sown was left to vegetate, the leaven being inserted was left to ferment, and both according to the laws of nature, laws nevertheless disposed and controlled by that providence which conducts the affairs of the universe, though by an influence inscrutable and generally undistinguishable by us. And in this, Christianity is analogous to most other provisions for happiness. The provision is made, and, being made, is left to act according to laws which, forming a part of a more general system, regulate this particular subject in common with many others. Let the constant recurrence to our observation of contrivance, design, and wisdom in the works of nature once fix upon our minds the belief of a God, and after that all is easy. In the counsels of a being possessed of the power and disposition which the Creator of the universe must possess, it is not improbable that there should be a future state. It is not improbable that we should be acquainted with it. A future state rectifies everything. Because if moral agents be made in the last event, happy or miserable, according to their conduct in the station and under the circumstances in which they are placed, it seems not very material by the operation of what causes, according to what rules, or even, if you please to call it so, by what chance or caprice these stations are assigned or these circumstances determined. This hypothesis, therefore, solves all that objection to the divine care and goodness which the promiscuous distribution of good and evil. I do not mean in the doubtful advantages of riches and grandeur, but in the unquestionably important distinctions of health and sickness, strength and infirmity, bodily ease and pain, mental alacrity and depression, is apt on so many occasions to create. This one truth changes the nature of things, gives order to confusion, makes the moral world of a piece with the natural. Nevertheless, a higher degree of assurance than that to which it is possible to advance this, or any argument drawn from the light of nature, was necessary, especially to overcome the shock which the imagination and the senses received from the effects and the appearances of death, and the obstruction which thence arises to the expectation of either a continued or a future existence. This difficulty, although of a nature no doubt to act very forcibly, will be found, I think, upon reflection to reside more in our habits of apprehension than in the subject, and that the giving way to it when we have any reasonable grounds or the contrary is rather an indulging of the imagination than anything else. Abstractedly considered, that is, considered without relation to the difference which habit, and merely habit, produces in our faculties and modes of apprehension, I do not see anything more in the resurrection of a dead man than in the conception of a child, except it be this, that the one comes into his world with a system of prior consciousness about him, which the other does not. And no person will say that he knows enough of either subject to perceive that this circumstance makes such a difference in the two cases that the one should be easy and the other impossible, the one natural, the other not so. To the first man, the succession of the species would be as incomprehensible as the resurrection of the dead is to us. Thought is different from motion, perception from impact. The individuality of a mind is hardly consistent with the divisibility of an extended substance, or its volition, that is, its power of originating motion, with the inertness which cleaves to every portion of matter which our observation or our experiments can reach. These distinctions lead us to an immaterial principle. At least, they do this. They so negative the mechanical properties of matter in the constitution of a sentient, still more of a rational, being, that no argument drawn from the properties can be of any great weight in opposition to other reasons, when the question respects the changes of which such a nature is capable, or the manner in which these changes am affected. Whatever thought be, or whatever it depend upon the regular experience of sleep, makes one thing concerning it certain, that it can be completely suspended and completely restored. If anyone find it too great a strain upon his thoughts to admit the notion of a substance strictly immaterial, that is, from which extension and solidity are excluded, he can find no difficulty in allowing that a particle as small as a particle of light, minuter than all conceivable dimensions, may just as easily be the depositary, the organ, and the vehicle of consciousness as the congeries of animal substance which forms a human body or the human brain. That being so, it may transfer a proper identity to whatever shall hereafter be united to it, may be safe amidst the destruction of its integuments, may connect the natural with the spiritual, the corruptible with the glorified body. If it be said that the mode and means of all this is imperceptible by our senses, it is only what is true of the most important agencies and operations. The great powers of nature are all invisible. Gravitation, electricity, magnetism, though constantly present and constantly exerting their influence, though within us, near us, and about us, though diffused throughout all space, overspreading the surface or penetrating the contexture of all bodies with which we are acquainted, depend upon substances and actions which are totally concealed from our senses. The Supreme Intelligence is so Himself. But whether these or any other attempts to satisfy the imagination bear any resemblance to the truth, or whether the imagination, which, as I have said before, is the mere slave of habit, can be satisfied or not. When a future state and the revelation of a future state is not only perfectly consistent with the attributes of the being who governs the universe, but when it is more, when it alone removes the appearance of contrariety which attends the operations of his will towards creatures capable of comparative merit and demerit, of reward and punishment, when a strong body of historical evidence, confirmed by many internal tokens of truth and authenticity, gives us just reason to believe that such a revelation hath actually been made, we ought to set our minds at rest with the assurance that in the resources of creative wisdom, expedients cannot be wanted to carry into effect what the Deity hath purposed, that either a new and mighty influence will descend upon the human world to resuscitate extinguished consciousness, or that, amidst the other wonderful contrivances with which the universe abounds and by some of which we see animal life, in many instances assuming improved forms of existence, acquiring new organs, new perceptions, and new sources of enjoyment, provision is also made, though by methods secret to us, as all the great processes of nature are, for conducting the objects of God's moral government through the necessary changes of their frame to those final distinctions of happiness and misery which He hath declared to be reserved for obedience and transgression, for virtue and vice, for the use and the neglect, the right and the wrong employment of the faculties and opportunities with which He hath been pleased, severally, to entrust and to try us.